Hey guys, it's your boy JC.
And Dr. Capel.
And welcome to the Dream 10X podcast, episode 85.
We are really getting up there.
In age?
That too.
Your outfit, by the way.
Isn't it fantastic?
Rawr. This week we are reviewing the book, Five Equations. That Changed the World by Dr. Michael Guilin. Dr. Michael Guilin. This book came out in 1995, and we're going to talk about five equations that changed the world in less than 20 minutes. So here we go.
And go.
Okay, so the first equation is, and I'll try to show this in the video, but it was founded by Sir Isaac Newton, and what the context is, of course, the bubonic plague is running rampant through London, and he goes and lives in his family's countryside estate, and he's sitting under an apple tree, deep in thought about the world and the universe, and he notices an apple fall from the tree, and he looks up, and it wasn't just the apple. This is the other thing that really struck me. It wasn't just an apple that fell from the tree, but as he looked up at the tree, he saw the moon. And it was the context of the moon floating in the sky above the earth and the apple falling that made him think, why is it that the apple fell to the ground, but the moon still hangs in the sky?
Wow.
So he got to thinking about that. That doesn't make any sense. And so he pondered gravity. And as I read that, I'm like, well, what the heck is gravity? I don't even understand what gravity is. Do you understand what gravity is?
It's the Earth's pulling rotation the Earth's rotation that helps us be rooted to the ground?
I don't think rotation has... It would be the opposite. The spinning motion of the Earth, the centrifugal force, would spin us all out into space.
So it's the whole orbit thing around the... Like the sun and the moon, like, keep us in space, right? On the ground?
Come to find out. This is stuff we should all know as grade school from grade school.
I feel like we may have learned it.
And we have been taught this, but it didn't sink into me until just as I read this book and started thinking about it. That all matter, gravitation is a universal force, and all matter is pulled to each other. Just as a universal force. There's probably a lot more science to that, but all matter is drawn to one another.
So that's gravity.
So it's a universal force. So we're a body on another body, being the Earth, and Earth is the larger mass, so it holds us to itself because it's the larger mass. And the moon is also pulled into the Earth as a smaller mass, being drawn to it by a larger mass, but because of the centrifugal force of the moon's orbit, it stays out in space and doesn't crash into Earth.
Interesting.
And so it's a combination of the universal force of gravity and the centrifugal force of the moon spinning in around in its orbit that it stays out there.
Wow.
And we stay grounded on Earth.
That is so wild.
And that's why the apple fell, because it's a smaller mass.
Yeah. Is that why I fall down a lot? Because I'm a small mass?
Probably. So the equation that Newton ended up deriving from his thought experiments relative to the apple and the moon is that the gravitational force equals the gravitational constant that Newton defined times the mass of one object times the mass of another object divided by the distance between the two.
Wow.
You know, Newton also invented calculus, which also helped in terms of defining the orbits of planets and how they weren't actually circular, they were elliptical, and all that crazy stuff is a tribute to the genius of Newton. What a
incredible brain, yeah.
One of the quotes I wrote down was, gravity was a force of attraction that was felt mutually by all... by all particles everywhere in the universe. In short, Newton concluded gravity was the glue that held everything together.
Pretty incredible.
And all of his discoveries were built on the shoulders of a lot of people who railed against the Catholic Church before him, including Galileo, who had to fight against the Catholic Church and kind of proving that it wasn't the Earth that was the center of the solar system, and everything revolved around the Earth, it mm-hmm. was the sun, and mm-hmm. everything revolved around the sun, but the Catholic Church didn't want to hear that, and there were a lot of other things. So there was a lot of pushback against the Catholic Church in order to bring Newton to the point where he could come up with his conclusions about gravity.
Wow.
So love that story. By the way, I love this book. It's just over 200 pages, just chock-a-block of really interesting stories about these scientists. So, all right, so that was Isaac Newton. Number two, Daniel Bernoulli. Bernoulli is the one who applied calculus that invented by Newton to fluids. So from solid objects that the calculus was applied to, he applied it to fluids to kind of calculate how fluids interact and impact hard things. Huh. And he discovered how fluids create pressure in a tube. And he also discovered that if you stick a glass tube in a vein, the blood will come out into the glass tube to show what your blood pressure is.
Whoa!
And so that's how they used to, based on Bernoulli, he's the one who said, we can take your blood pressure by sticking a glass tube in your vein.
That's crazy.
And it wasn't until years later when an Italian whose name was Scipione Rivarocci, who created the sphygmomanometer, which is the precursor of the modern day blood pressure cuff that sits externally. And so Bernoulli discovered that slow moving water through a tube creates more pressure than fast moving water through a tube.
Whoa.
And guess what?
What?
Years later, another scientist who magnanimously attributed his finding to what Bernoulli found earlier with the pressure of his discoveries around the pressure of fluids, that air traveling, faster under a wing than it would over a sloped wing created more pressure, which resulted in lift. Which described and explained how airplanes could fly. That's how the Wright brothers actually were able to get their craft off the ground in Kitty Hawk.
That's so cool.
All because of what Bernoulli had discovered.
Whoa.
All due to, this... I forgot about the equation. The equation related to pressure.
Yeah.
So his equation was his constant equals the pressure... plus the density of a fluid times the speed of that fluid squared. So basically what that says is that the slower the fluid moves, the more pressure it creates.
Wow.
So that was his... Zhukovsky, did I mention him? Zhukovsky is the guy who attributed his algorithm or his equation to also being synonymous with air. But Zhukovsky couldn't have made that leap between fluid and air if it weren't for Leonardo da Vinci. Da Vinci is the one who said, hey, fluid is a lot like air, the qualities of which are both the same. Isn't that fascinating?
That is so crazy.
So all of these scientists are riffing off of one another and creating more and more knowledge about how the universe actually works now.
Yeah.
Number three, and this guy was probably my favorite, Michael Faraday. He was also in England. Newton was in England. Bernoulli was in Basel, Switzerland.
Mm-hmm.
And Michael Faraday's back in England again. And he's also, I think, a little bit later than Newton and Bernoulli, maybe. I forget the timeline exactly. But this guy grew up poor, didn't have any money, and he was interested in science. Mm. But science was, the practice of science was basically something only wealthy people practiced because they had the time and the inclination and the money to do so. But somehow Faraday kept applying himself, kept seeking out mentors. He found a way. He was a bookbinder. He found a way into a mentor's lab, and who took him in and allowed him to do his own experimentation. And he started learning a heck of a lot on his own. And he ultimately became the guy who discovered the dynamo, the electric dynamo.
What's that?
So basically he discovered that if you have an electromagnet, a magnet, and you move a wire through the electrical field, that generates electricity. or vice versa. If you move the magnet through the through a wire, it generates an electric field.
Cool.
And so that's how we, the dynamo is our contemporary generator, electrical generator.
Whoa!
And so he discovered that. And the other cool aspect about him was, you know, he was a commoner, he's a blue collar guy. He just was very methodical about his experimentation and the scientific method. And he wasn't highly educated, but he educated himself on how to do things and how to actually arrive at the truth of things.
Whoa.
He was also a Sandemanian.
What does that mean?
Sandemanian. It's a kind of a Christian related sect.
Okay.
And so they believed in simplicity and truth and all that. So that influenced how he conducted his scientific discovery. And he also believed that math was simply just, mathematics was just a language of humans, and that things should be described and explained in English to the, so that the common man can understand how stuff works. So
yes.
His equation for how the dynamo actually worked, how electricity and magnetism actually, or how magnetism works to generate electricity, was actually written in English, so that anybody could understand how it worked. And it wasn't until later when a Scotsman came along and said, "Ah, I gotta take this and make it a mathematical equation so the scientists can understand how it works." So basically, the Scotsman's name was James Clerk Maxwell, and he wrote the equation. And again, I'll try to show this, but it's the, what is it? The change of electricity equals the rate of increase or decrease of the change in the magnetism, something like that.
Sure, sounds great.
The English is easier to understand. But one of the things he said is, only the facts from well-run experiments clearly stated in plain English were what mattered. And so I really like that about him. And it made me think about, okay, well, what really is mathematics? It's a man-made language. Mm-hmm. Newton contributed to the confusion of what mathematical symbols were with a calculus and all that. But it's just a language, and it's just like English. And you can describe and explain algorithms using English just as well as you can mathematics, just as well as you can using computer code, etc. It's just another form of showing what's actually taking place through some algorithm or through some chain of logic.
Yeah.
So it was really interesting to contemplate mathematics and language and how it all kind of works together for a similar purpose based on how Faraday thought about the whole thing.
That's wild.
So I really liked reading about him.
Yeah.
Okay, number four. Now we're in Prussia, and we're not talking about Clausewitz, we're talking about Rudolf Clausius.
That's close!
It's very close. It's like Prussians, all Prussians have a similar last name, I don't know. So this guy was really interesting too. He came up with the conclusion that basically the universe is dying. And that one day, all energy in the universe is going to come to rest, and the universe is just going to be a big lukewarm blob of nothingness.
Well, that's sad.
And he based that off of the idea that, or off of the observations that, you know, all hot things eventually become cold.
Okay.
If they're left alone and there's no energy infused to something, all hot and warm things become, you know, lukewarm or cold, including human bodies. So we have energy. Our human body is constantly burning energy, and we're warm, blooded animals.
Yeah.
But when we die, we go cold. So it's just like everything else in the universe. It's everything is just eventually going to die out, including the sun, in roughly 44 billion years or whatever. So it was kind of
doom.
It's his story. The way it was, Dr. Gillen wrote it, is very. It's kind of sad, actually. It was very colorful, well written. story that really intrigued me about the death of his wife and all of that. It was really sad, and how he held her hand and she was warm and then she went cold, and how he was contemplating why that is and how the universe actually works. And man, it just made me think a lot. But his equation was the change of the total entropy in the universe is always greater than zero. So life rails against entropy. Life is organization, it's energy, and all life in the universe rails against entropy. However, all entropy in the universe is always going to be greater than zero. So it's just getting bigger. It's not getting less. Actually, life and energy in the universe supposedly is getting less. Things I read in here was that, pulled out of his story, was that we get 17 million billion kilowatt hours worth of energy from the sun every day.
Good grief. That's a lot.
That is a lot. That is a, I mean, a tremendous amount of energy from the sun. And so the sun plays a really, the energy from the sun plays a really important role in the life of Einstein, as we'll see here in a second. And I did want to read a little bit about the casino of life that he talks about here, which helps explain how entropy works. He says, Clausius. Clausius's law of entropy non-conservation was like saying that a casino's positive money changes always exceeded its negative money changes. In other words, a casino's winnings always exceeded its losses. It always made a profit. This is like Vegas. So the universe is like Vegas, which was how it stayed in business. A casino existed at the expense of its players, which are us and every other living thing in the universe, which meant it could keep winning only so long as its players could keep losing. When they had lost everything, when positive money changes ceased to exist, the casino was shut down forever. The end of the world. The casino's gone. Similarly, Clausius's law of entropy non-conservation meant that, like a casino, the universe existed at the expense of its engines, the human engine included. So long as the universe continued to make a profit, as it were, so long as the positive entropy changes exceeded the negative ones, it would stay in business.
That is fascinating.
Man.
That's a really good analogy.
Easy to understand. The casino analogy.
The casino of life.
So that's Clausius, and that really made me think a lot, too, about life. And then, finally, number five, Albert Einstein. And we all know what equation Albert Einstein is famous for. It's what?
E equals C squared.
E equals M times C squared.
So, I always think of it in the Michelle, so I always go M squared C. So I have two BFFs who are named Michelle, and I always get this equation backwards because of them, because I'm always like M squared C, and it's anyway.
Yeah, anyway. So E equals MC squared stands for energy. E is the energy equals M, which is the mass, times the speed of light squared. So what does that mean? I mean, when you start thinking about what the implications of this equation are, it's I don't know. I still can't even quite tell you, but it has to do with mass and energy. And, you know, all things have mass. I don't even know if I think even light has mass.
Yeah, I think everything has mass from what, and even atoms have
all
mass.
Things have mass. Yeah. And if you take a mass times the speed of light squared, you end up with you end up with this crazy energy. So I guess all mass has energy in it, and the speed of light is like I don't understand how the speed of light is related to all this. This is a very simple equation, hugely complicated thing to break out and actually understand it. But one thing that I pulled out of that as being, you know, simple and something I could get my head around that was very, very fascinating was any mass that is moving. Increases its mass. So when you're running, your mass increases by some tiny bit.
Yeah.
But if your mass is going the speed of light, all of a sudden your mass is infinite. if you're going as fast as the speed of light, you are infinite and you are everywhere at once.
Oh, that's cool.
So that's what I was like trying to get my head around. I'm like, so nobody, so that's, and that made Einstein realize, oh, there's either something wrong with my equation, or it is not possible to exceed, for anything to exceed the speed of light, because it would just, the mass would just be infinite, according to the equation.
Yeah.
And so he couldn't even get his head around it, right? So how are we supposed to figure it out? But it's really interesting to think about how everything that's in movement is increasing its mass the faster and faster it goes. And it's inconsequential for humans on Earth. Even if you're in a jet going 400, 500, 600, 800 miles an hour, it's very insignificant. Even if you're in a spaceship thousands of miles an hour, it's insignificant. But if you're going the speed of light, you're instantly everywhere. So what if you could be alive and going the speed of light, what would that look like?
Like the Flash. Bringing it back to superheroes.
And so coming back to, light, the speed of light. So is that infinite mass? Like, light is so powerful. And Feynman has this great thing, Richard Feynman, the physicist, has this great bit where he's talking about how trees convert sunlight into energy, and that sunlight knocks the carbon out of the oxygen molecule to release oxygen and use the carbon, sequester the carbon, but it also sequesters the sunlight.
Yeah.
And so when you cut down a tree and you burn it in a fire, the light that's being given off by that is sunlight that was sequestered by the tree. And so the fire is just this really primitive way of releasing that energy from the mass. And there's a lot of waste as a result of that, that chemical reaction. And, you know, there's coal and there's ash and whatever. But Einstein figured out a way to release that energy at the nuclear level, which we use to create an atomic bomb.
Yeah.
Just a huge amount of energy released all at once.
Yeah.
Based on his understanding of this equation in light and matter.
Incredible.
So you got one side of the, you got one side of the equation where you got this really inefficient chemical reaction releasing energy in the form of a burning log that was sequestered freaking sunlight. And then you got the other hand where we're blowing up entire cities using a similar concept. Why can't we create universally free energy using something in between, you know, a more efficient way to, because what he says in this thing about coal, let me see where I can, let me stay on target. He says, coal has taken millions of years to form, the result of dead plants being buried under layers of heavy rock and compressed by the inexorable movements of the Earth's shifting continents. By burning a lump of coal, the solar and seismic energies that had gone into making it in the first place were released into the form of thermal energy. Einstein's mass energy equation promised us far greater yields, however, if we could only find a way to convert the same lump of coal completely into energy with no ash being left behind. A simple calculation revealed, in fact, that such a transmogrification would produce enough energy to keep one light bulb burning for not 4 hours, but 1,680 billion hours.
Whoa.
So an efficient way to get energy out of matter can provide free energy for everybody forever. Yeah. But why haven't we figured out how to blow up a freaking whole everybody? We know how to blow up everybody using that concept, but we somehow haven't figured out how to create free energy for everybody. Now I'm really curious, what's going on? Why have we not figured this out?
Well, and like, maybe we have, but there's not a lot of funding in it because of the electric companies.
I don't know.
And the other companies that are
I think we have figured out how it's just not going to get out
because of the economy. Yeah.
Yeah, the political action committees or whatever pushing, because that doesn't make sense to me now. Yeah. Now I'm like, well, we've had this capability since World War II of having a really good understanding of the relationship between mm-hmm. energy and mass and speed of light and all that, and there's no free energy. We don't get any free energy out of that. And with that, thanks for watching this episode. We'll see you next book. Over and out.
Bye.